So tonight I want to finish this long series of talks I've been giving on the Four Noble Truths and look at the last three steps of the Eightfold Path, the Fourth Noble Truth. And this is where we now get deep into practice itself. So everything else was practice. Now we're talking about more precisely the formal meditative practice. And that's what these steps are primarily about, though they also relate to life in the world, and I'll talk about that as well. So we're talking here about wise effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. And wise effort is basically looking at, okay, I've gone through the rest of this process. I have right understanding. I've set my intention. I've put my life out in the world in order. But now I have to put some effort into the practice. But it has to be wise effort. I mean, I can put effort into, going to the bar every night and driving my car there and back. That takes effort, but that might not be particularly useful from a Dharma point of view. So how do we look at this? And I want to start by reading something by Ajahn Chah. So Ajahn Chah was one of the primary lineage holders that the Western students, when they were in Thailand, studied with Ajahn Chah. He was the teacher of many of the senior teachers in this Western Buddhist world that I'm part of. And he had some quite strong words to say here, actually. Practice has to depend on steadfastness and patient endurance. Some people start to practice meditation and they have ideas and desires as to how they want it to be. They expect the mind to be calm right away. But the old seeds and habits of turmoil are there, so the practitioners will have to experience their ripening. It is important to make efforts where this distress appears. We might feel that we would be fine without such disciplines that cause us to feel bothered and oppressed. We could eat and sleep in comfort and at will. We could talk about whatever we like when we have the urge. We could go here and there as we wish and follow our impulses, like this would bring well-being. The teachings of the Buddha talk about resisting, grating against things. The way of transcendence grates against the worldly. Right view grates against wrong view. Purity grates against impurity. These things are always going to be incompatible. In the scripture, there's a fable to illustrate this. Before the Buddha attained enlightenment, when he had accepted and eaten rice porridge from the milkmaid Sujata, he set the dish on the surface of a southerly flowing river and made the aspiration, "If I'm going to become a supremely awakened Buddha, may this dish flow north." The dish flowed to the north as it went against the current. And that's a great image because it's talking about how this practice, in some senses, when we take this practice and go deeply into it, we realize we're going against the current of our culture to a certain extent. And in some places that it might be more so than others, but it's always the case. Here's one issue, really interesting issue, and I've had some discussions with people about this several times. Basically, we're told, and this is something you hear all the time, that we all have Buddha nature, that we're sort of naturally pure and perfect. And yeah, this is true, but why do we need to do anything then? Why do we need to put any effort into anything? It's that in terms of absolute reality, this may be true. In terms of absolute reality, we all have Buddha nature and we're all naturally perfect. But in terms of relative reality, in our the day world we live in and operating in, the way we operate day to day, you don't know, in quotes, know this. We don't experience it. In fact, just the opposite is what we often experience. The world seems to be full of suffering, and you seem to be anything but perfect. At least I do. Maybe you're all perfect, but I certainly don't feel perfect. So some teachings advise you need to just let go, just sink into your true nature. That's how you can find this Buddha nature. If that sounds, I just sink into it. That sounds pretty easy, but it isn't. Letting go paradoxically takes a great amount of effort because we're letting go of all our old habits. Letting go implies that we drop all our usual reactive habits of mind. To do that, we first have to see them, which takes effort. And then we have to go, oh, that means I have to actually change. Ooh. And most of the time, we're trying to be staying in touch with the present moment, but most of the time our mind is anywhere but in the present moment, right? It's off in the past, remembering things that happened and how wonderful or horrible they were, or off in the future, imagining how wonderful or horrible they're going to be, but it was certainly not in the present moment. So to shift these patterns takes effort. The word virya, which is usually translated as effort, sometimes also as energy, the root word of that is vira, which means it's translated from the Pali as a hero. You not only need to put energy into the practice, you have to do it courageously. It's like heroically. You might not have thought of yourself as a Dharma hero, but in certain Buddhist schools that really emphasize this sort of thing, particularly in some of the Zen schools, that being a hero is like that whole samurai tradition underneath the Zen world. At the same time, however, putting too much effort in doesn't work either. Especially, if it's that sort of like, I'm going to do this. If it kills me, I'm going to be enlightened this week sort of energy. It just gets in the way. It's like, it turns the practice into something you're supposed to succeed at, right? You need to fulfill some sense of obligation. It's my duty to succeed and be perfect and enlightened, right? And it just turns the practice kind of grim. There's that old expression, all work and no play makes Jack a dull boy. And it really applies here. So we have to be careful. We have to sort of, and this is part of the wisdom of wise effort. It's like, oh, am I pushing too hard? Am I turning this into some grim duty? Oh, I'm going to get up and meditate again today. And yes, I'm so, we're sort of like we're grumbling to ourselves as we go sit in our chair. That isn't too useful. We have to sort of relax into our true nature, not force ourselves into it. Right? There's certainly statues of the Buddha. If you ever look at, I spend a lot of time looking at statues of the Buddha because I painted a whole bunch of them. Every one of them, the Buddha has a small little smile. It isn't like a big grin, but he's definitely not grimacing. He's smiling, but it's a subtle little smile. You're actually supposed to enjoy this practice. This practice is supposed to make you happy. If it's grim, something has gone off here. So, how do we know if what we're doing is the best thing to do? And basically, the right effort talks about these four different aspects of right effort. This is also a classic Eastern teaching tool. Let's take everything, and it can be yes or no, but then It could be yes and no, or not yes and not no. You know, there's always things in fours. It's just the way philosophically things work. So these four aspects of right effort, or wholesome effort, or wise effort. And the first, and you, when you think about these things, they're like, oh yeah, they all seem pretty wise. When I first heard this, it struck me as like, yeah, this is well thought out. Okay. So the first aspect is to do whatever you can to prevent unwholesome mind states from arising. Seems to make a lot of sense, right? It's like if I'm trying to maintain mindfulness and concentration and other wholesome mind states like joy, I should do what I can to make sure that the unwholesome mind states don't arise in the first place. So what does this mean in terms of practice? So in practice, you see a familiar pattern of thought arising. And you know that if you sort of get hooked on that thought pattern, start, ruminating about it yet again, it's just going to take you to places where you're going to have more suffering. Guaranteed. You know this. So you go, oh, let's not go there. I don't need to do this. I liken this to, you're a fish and someone keeps dropping hooks with this juicy bait into the water, and they're drifting along and you're swimming, and sure enough you see that juicy bait, and what do? You bite down again, and there you are, caught on the hook, flopping around again, just like that. Instead going, oh, I know. That's nice looking bait, but I don't need to go there. 'Cause I know what happens. So this is sort of right understanding of the first five steps. This is right understanding of, based on what you've done from in the first five steps of the practice. They just prepare you for this thing, because you have right intention, you understand how to live a wholesome life, and you're going, oh wait, I can see this isn't going to be wholesome. Maybe I won't do that. And it's really helpful with this one to have a sense of humor, to be able to see that thing arise. Oh, there's that old bait again, and just laugh at yourself, because you have no control over that bait being there. It's gonna come. I mean, this is like causes and conditions are such that this stuff arises. But if you can laugh at yourself, it takes all the power of that bait away. It's like, oh, it's just that one again. It's a different. It's like changing the attitude, saying, I don't need to do that, and how ridiculous it would be if I did. So have the sort of humility and laughter are very skillful tools at this point. So what about in day-to-day life, however? Because in day-to-day life, I mean, if you think about our practices, like, oh, I got this half hour I sit, or 45 minutes, whatever it is your sitting practice is, then I got the rest of my life. If I'm not applying right effort in the rest of my life, what condition is my mind going to be in when I go and sit? So we have to see how this all fits together. And basically, what wholesome effort or wise effort is in the rest of our life is we have to look at our entire life, everything we do. How we eat, who we eat with, where we eat, what we do, just everything, and go, is this wholesome or not? Is this useful? Is this skillful? Especially the things we do habitually, that we sort of fall into, we fall into a pattern, and sure we are, just, oh wait, how did I end up doing this again? Or ending up, hanging out with these people again, or whatever it is, and see whether those things lead to wholesome or unwholesome mind states. And then start shifting our life, being really honest with ourselves. This, we slowly change our life patterns to ones that are more conducive to practice. Okay, so that's the first one. The second aspect of right effort is to do whatever you can to get rid of an unwholesome mind state if one is actually arisen. So there I am sitting, and then I remember I'm sitting, but I just realize I've been in this long 5-minute rant that I have repeated many times in my mind yet again. Or that 5-minute, oh, poor me, aren't I just, I'm just like, it's horrible, everything's horrible, I'm so horrible. Whatever those, whatever your favorite kind of story is, right? We all have our favorite kinds of stories. What do we do now? Well, first of all, this implies, right effort here, wise effort here implies that we can actually see that that's what's happened. That's a huge skill right there. This is where mindfulness is really useful. Here I am in the midst of something, and then we go, oh, it's that story again. And you can sort of feel it because you're having, typically these have reactive energies in the body. So you feel yourself getting tense or excited or whatever, the story is. And know that, oh, yeah, I bit down on that bait and I'm flopping around. But I don't have to. And the best advice I ever got, and it's I keep giving this to other people as I teach, because it seems to work for me, is when I catch myself in that, it's when in those places you're all up in your head, you're all caught in the mental process. And if you can drop down into your body, just go into your body and feel what it feels like right now. Like be consciously choose to be mindfulness of body at that point. This does two things. One, it sort of turns off, doesn't turn off the story. The story's still sort of running in background. But it's like a movie and you're not watching it anymore. You're watching it how that movie has affected you. So you've sort of stepped back from the energy of that movie and really tuned into, whatever, that the emotional energy of that story has created it, things in the body. The body will have reacted. And tune into that and go, oh, and tune into how unpleasant it is, because typically these things are always going to be unpleasant energies. And this allows you to sort of step back and go, no, I don't. This is a way to disengage when you're caught in the midst. Sometimes, that's not, may not be enough. However, I mean, this is like, that's the best thing. I've also told people at times, especially because some of these stories have, people in them that are part of the story, that and you, they are like the villain. Often, or maybe you're the villain and they're the hero, whatever. Sometimes shifting into metta for that person, whether it's yourself or the person you're ranting about, just trying to change the channel in your mind and go, oh, let's have thoughts of love and kindness towards this person instead of ranting about them yet again. Sometimes that can work as well as another way to sort of cut the cord. And the other thing is, you have to accept the fact that this emotional energy is there and it's real and there's nothing wrong with it. Oh, that's the key. There's nothing wrong with the fact that here I am sitting here being angry. I'm just a human being. I've got caught in this story and here I am ranting again and here's all that strong, powerful energy going through my body. And be able to go, that's okay. If I can accept that energy, and now sort of look at that just becomes my object of mindfulness. Now I'm in a wholesome mindset. I'm in being mindful of what's going on. It might be really unpleasant, but I'm being mindful of it. Now you're in a skillful place. It's like it's not like we have to make those things go away. It's that we just have to be aware of them and be able to look at them honestly and feel them openly and not get swept away. So it's not has not we're not trying to stop them or get rid of them. We're just trying to let them, I mean, if this is about paying attention to what's arising in the moment. Well, this is what's arisen in the moment, so let's pay attention to it. That's what we want to do. Sometimes even that may not be enough. Joseph Goldstein has this great little story. This is from his book, Mindfulness. And he's talking about a particular sutta that goes through all these long list of different ways to deal with unwholesome emotions when they arise. And this is, he says, sometimes you have to forcibly suppress unwholesome thoughts, which sounds like shocking, right? Like, wait, I thought we were sort of being supposed to be paying attention to what's going on. And that's absolutely true. But if the same old story keeps repeating over and over and over, and you have skillfully dropped into the body and paid attention and, you know, hung in with it and sort of, and you've done that five times. That's Joseph's number. It could be 10 or it could be 3, depending on who you are, how strong it is and whatever. But if you've done it a number of times, and now here's the story again. Now it's time to say, enough of this. This is what Joseph has to say. He says, one way of doing this is imagining oneself shooting down these thoughts as soon as they arise. Like shooting down targets at an amusement park shooting gallery. I found this method particularly helpful with recurrent unwholesome thoughts that have already been seen so many times that it's not a question of denial or suppression of the feeling. Here it's an attitude that takes no quarter but involves a sense of humor. I call this method cowboy dharma. How suitable for us folks here in the West, right? It's like, I'm going to get those thoughts. I'm not going to let them, you know, it's like you can imagine him doing this. I mean, Joseph can be quite funny when he talks, so I can see him saying this, actually. Anyhow, it's just something, but all of this is in service of, if our unwholesome mindset's arisen and we see that that's what's happened, then we can actively do things to shift the story, change the story. Skillfully, carefully, without suppression, without denial, without just sort of, you know, running away. Oh God, I'm never supposed to be angry. I'm supposed to be a holy Buddhist, so as soon as anger arises, I run someplace else. No, sometimes I have to look at my anger and go, oh, look at this. This is what anger feels like, and be very mindful of it. Different. Okay. The third aspect of right effort is the sort of a partner to the first. Do whatever you can to cultivate wholesome mind states. Once again, it's like, duh. Of course, it makes perfect sense, right? Seems so obvious. Do things that bring calm, joy, compassion, loving kindness, equanimity, mindfulness, concentration. But how often do we actually do this? Consciously choose to live our life in this way. We have to think about all the choices we make with this in mind. Like every time we make a choice, we have to go, does this lead towards more wholesome mind states arising or not? I mean, if it's neutral, like, yeah, I got to go get some groceries. Okay, that's a pretty neutral thought. But a lot of things we choose, it's like, which way does this one go? And actually consciously make choices based on whether this leads, as best we can see, because we're all fallible, of course, as best we can see, does this lead towards a more wholesome mind state or not? And do whatever we can to create the causes and conditions that such that a wholesome mind state will arise and more wholesome mind states will arise and continue and last longer. Which gets us to the fourth and final aspect of right effort. And this is often the most difficult one. When wholesome mind states have arisen in the mind, do whatever you can to preserve them. Oh, look, I'm really calm right now. Oh, I'm feeling joyful. Whatever it is, do what we can to preserve them. So first off, once again, you have to be mindful enough to see that this has happened, that a wholesome mind state has arisen. And this actually takes quite a bit of effort because we're basically programmed mentally and hardwired in our primitive brain level to look for what's wrong. Because, 10,000 years ago, there we were out in the plain living in our little tribe, making sure that another tribe doesn't attack us or know some animals are going to come and eat me or someone's, all the horrible things that could happen on a day-to-day, moment-to-moment basis. So we always had to be alert. Well, we don't live like that so much anymore. Though sometimes our culture makes us feel like we should be on the alert all the time. That's not true. And so we have to sort of overcome our hard wiring, which t is always telling us, look out, something wrong is going to happen any second now. And this is not easy. It's like, and also, we're taught to judge ourselves as unworthy of having joy or calm. Somehow, I'm not good enough. It's way easier to see the unwholesome and the unpleasant. It's way easier to see that because that's what we're sort of hardwired to see anyway, right? So when you experience a wholesome mind state, you first of all have to need to just accept it. Ah, joy has arisen. Ah, calm has arisen. Whatever it is, just notice it, note it, be okay with it. Instead of falling into that energy of, oh, I can't be calm like this. I need to stay on edge and be watchful, or I don't deserve to be happy like this. Because as soon as you go to those places, now you've lost the wholesome mind state and now you're caught in an unwholesome mind state again. Just like that. Just like our old habits take us right out of the wholesome back into the unwholesome. So you have to learn to be that it's okay to be calm and joyful. You have to learn to let yourself be filled with wholesome mind states. And this takes effort. It doesn't just happen. I mean, there's no magic. It's just practice. And this is the practice of, so right effort, wholesome effort, wise effort is a very distinct practice. I mean, it has these four steps, right? Doing whatever we can so that unwholesome mind states don't arise. Doing whatever we can if an unwholesome mind state has arisen to shift to a wholesome mind state or a neutral mind state at least. Do whatever we can so that wholesome mind states arise. And when a wholesome mind state has arisen, do what we can to preserve it. This is all quite effortful. This is where the effort and energy of practice goes into exactly this place. Because now we get to the last two steps, right? Right mindfulness and right concentration. And so the first six steps are basically creating the causes and conditions such that mindfulness and concentration can arise. That's what they're all about. It's like, can I create the causes and conditions so that the wholesome mind states of mindfulness and concentration will arise? The first six steps basically explain how to do that. Okay. And so, what do we mean by mindfulness? I think it's probably a pretty valid question. And that's in the tradition I'm teaching from. There's two sort of particular ways you can practice. One is we'll call Vipassana, right? Which is has many different techniques. It's brings the mind into states of awareness of what is arising in the moment. That's the traditional explanation for what Vipassana mindfulness is. It's a mind state, it's a mental factor, and basically causes and can, the practice, the formal form of the practice, whether it's sitting practice or walking practice, creates the possibility for mindfulness to arise. And but so then the question is, well, how do I know if how do I know if mindfulness has arisen? And I can't give you a really super duper answer for that, because it's sort of like, oh yeah, there, when it arises, it's like, oh, this is mindfulness. I mean, it's like partly it's that, like there's no, but there are what are called the qualities of mindfulness. And there's four principal qualities that that Joseph lays out, and I want to talk about this. First one is not forgetting. You're doing your practice. Don't forget what you're doing. Stay firmly with the object. There's an image that I've seen in several different commentaries where they say your mind should be fixed solidly like a post that is stuck in the ground. This, having put many posts and grounds in all my carpentry days of fences and decks and stuff, I like this image because it's like, yeah, when you put one in there, it's really solid. That's how I want my mind to be. I want to be solid like that post stuck in the ground. So it's like, stay firmly with the object. Don't forget. And then the second one is presence. Which means not looking away, not giving in to aversion. It's like we have to go, I have to be present for everything. I can't just be present for the good stuff, the pleasant stuff, the sweet stuff, the wonderful stuff. But then, oh, there's this really unpleasant thing. No, I think I'll step way back over here someplace. I don't want to be present for that. But we have to be present for all of it, the 10,000 joys and the 10,000 sorrows. And we have to be willing to experience all of it, not just the good stuff. We have to stay present, have presence. And then there's another thing, and I like this one because it's called remembering. And remembering, I think of this as, I'm sitting there and I'm off in one of my mind wandering times as I'm doing my formal practice. And then at some point, you sort of go, oh, and you remember. You remember, oh, wait, I'm doing my sitting practice. And here's my mind noodling off, planning what shopping I have to do later in the day or whatever it is. Our minds go all kinds of places like that. Doesn't have to be a bad thing. It's just mind wandered. And we remember, oh, I'm sitting. And that remembering, the word sati in Pali, which is often translated as mindfulness, also translates simply as remembering. But I want to read something Joseph has to say about this as well. And he says that this aspect is one that we don't often associate with mindfulness, but in fact, it harkens back to its root meaning of remembering. Here, mindfulness calls to mind or remembers what is skillful and what is not, what is inferior and what is refined, what is beneficial and what is harmful. In this aspect of mindfulness that makes it possible to follow the Buddha's instructions to let go and abandon what is unskillful and to develop and cultivate what is skillful. So this is another aspect of remembering besides the one I was talking about. He's talking about, we remember, oh, look at that. I know what that is. This is skill, we remember things. Mindfulness thus becomes a key factor in strengthening our inner moral compass. If we don't remember and call to mind what is wholesome and what is not, then we simply toss about it on the waves of habitual mind states, often acting out the latent tendencies of different defilements. It sounds pretty grim, but this is exactly what we do. if we don't have the ability to remember what's wholesome and what isn't, if we're indiscriminate, let's just let it all go, then we get tossed around by our old habits. So part of the practice is actually remembering what we know about what's wholesome and what isn't. Okay. Finally, and I like this one too, this is an association with simplicity. It's like, and wisdom. You know, that phrase I often use when I'm teaching is to just sit and know you're sitting. Excuse me. Not making up stories about what we are experiencing. And this is something we do too. Some little noise happens and all of a sudden there we are off on some long story about what's causing the noise and who's out there and blah, 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 blah. I had a very powerful experience of this one myself. So this is a personal story where I was on one of my retreats at Spirit Rock. And at one point I told my teacher, at one of the interviews, oh, I'm waking up in the middle of the night and you know, around 2 in the morning. And he says, oh, if you wake up, maybe that's a good time to go practice. If you're awake, go do some formal practice. So that night I wake up about 2 in the morning and I put some clothes on. This is California, so it's not that cold, so I don't have to do it. It doesn't take long to get dressed. And I walk into the Dharma Hall, which is empty. I mean, usually there's like 90 or 100 people in the Dharma Hall. The Dharma Hall is empty. There is no one there. And I'm going, oh boy, I got the place all to myself. This is going to be great. You know, I'm all just like really keen and excited. And I sit down and I'm just practicing mindfulness. I'm being aware of what's arising. And I hear this sound, this sort of like sucking sound. And I'm going, and at first I just note hearing, but then my mind starts going and it's like, what's causing that sound, right? Why? Because I normally that sound isn't there. I mean, during the day, I don't hear this sound, but now there's this sound, this weird sound. And my mind starts building this entire story. Outside the hall, there's a pool, okay, with the Buddha statue sitting on a pedestal, and then there's this big pool that's right outside the Dharma Hall. And so it's got, you know, water circulation going on. And I decide, sitting there innocently at 2 in the morning in the Dharma Hall, that someone has died in the pool and they're blocking the outflow thing, and that's what's making the sound. And I become totally convinced that this is what's going on, to the point where, because part of me is going, oh, Barry, there you are, just making up crazy stories again, right? Don't believe, you don't. But it's like, I swear, I had to get up, go outside, and look in the pool. At which point, I just laughed hilariously to myself and went back to bed. But it was like, out of nothing, just this sound, this whole giant story about, you know, this and that. No, I'll have to go wake up the manager and we have to get an ambulance. Don't want to disturb other people. It's like this huge drama arose out of nothing. But we do this all the time. This is how our mind works. One little thing. This is called, there's a formal Pali term. This is called papancha. Translates roughly as proliferation. One little thing leads to five things that leads to, and all of a sudden you have a drama in your mind out of nothing but the sound of the water filter system changing the water, which it probably did every night at 2 in the morning when no one was there, so no one would be bothered by this crazy sound. Anyhow, this is what we do. One more thing from Joseph about mindfulness. This is actually he's actually quoting Bhikkhu Bodhi. Bhikkhu Bodhi is a respected elder in this tradition. and has written books. A lot of the translate. He was a translator for many years, and many of the translations of the Dhamma that I read from all the time are all his translations. Anyhow, this is Bhikkhu Bodhi's definition of right mindfulness. In the practice of right mindfulness, the mind is trained to remain in the present, open, quiet, and alert, contemplating the present event. All judgments and interpretations have to be suspended, or if they occur, just registered and drop. So I registered what was occurring, but I didn't drop it. That's my where I got out of line here. The task is simply to note whatever comes up just as it is occurring, riding the changes of events in the way a surfer rides the waves on the sea. The whole process is a way of coming back into the present, of standing in the here and now without slipping away, without being swept away by the tides of distracting thoughts. To practice mindfulness is thus a matter not so much of doing, but of undoing. I think that's a great line. It's not so much a practice of doing, but of undoing. Undoing our habitual patterns. It's an interesting way to think about it. To practice mindfulness is just a matter not so much of doing, but of undoing. Okay. So then, what's left here is concentration. The wholesome, right concentration. And basically, concentration arises when mindfulness is continuous. You know, when the momentum of mind, when mindfulness arises and it stays for a while, then deep states of concentration arise. And basically, in the mindfulness practice, we concentrate on a particular thing, or we concentrate in a more open way, right? Those are the two different definitions of mindfulness in a way. And so concentration in the noting form that I'm familiar with and that I'm always teaching is just basically paying attention to what's arising at any of the six sense doors. And then a few seconds later, well, what's there now? And a few seconds later, and what's there now? So this is concentration on a changing object. But the concentration comes from staying aware and moving skillfully from one object to the next. This is one form of concentration, where the object of concentration keeps changing, but the underlying process of changing from object to object is continuous. So this is one way of looking at concentration. The other way of concentration is to have a single point. You know, I spent a long time before I came to this practice doing mantra meditation. The mantra meditation is you have a particular sound or set of sounds or a phrase in my case, and you keep repeating that over, and you just keep coming back to that same point over and over and over. And there's like different forms of this, is visualization practices and mantra practices and different things you can do. In the Theravada tradition, this is where metta fits in, because metta has this simple set of phrases, and you keep repeating these phrases over and over and over and over. So now you've chosen a particular meditative object, and I'm going to concentrate on that. So it's more narrowly focused than the wide open sort of mindfulness form of practice. Though even in mindfulness practice, in traditional mindfulness practice, there are times when if say we're just practicing with just paying attention to the breath, where that it's a pretty narrow thing. This is a sort of a more concentrated form of mindfulness practice. Might be a good description to that. So there's places where these two ideas overlap quite clearly. So formal practice is sort of as this skillful combination of the balancing of these three different things, right? We're having wise effort, we're putting in effort, we're not overdoing it. Then we're being mindful, we're staying with our object, and we're concentrating. And this make this these three somehow blend together, and when they're in balance with each other, then our practice becomes very fruitful. That's the nature of the this. And that's so the last thing I want to point out, and this is almost the last thing, and that's that this Eightfold Path, when we think of a path as like it's going someplace, right? Well, actually, the Eightfold Path is more like a spiral. You start off the very beginning, you have some right, something that brought you to the practice, that initial moment of right understanding brought you to this practice. And then you formed an initial intention, and then you sort of try and got your life together a bit, and then you did some practice, formal practice. And then as you did that formal practice, you go a little bit deeper, and you get a deeper understanding. And oh, there I am back at right understanding again. But now your right understanding, your wholesome understanding is much clearer. You have a better idea of everything, which helps you form a more clear and precise intention, and allows you to then look more closely at your life to see what you've got to do to keep it together, which, and so on. So we're always, it's not as, we're just going circling through these things, and they're all, in a sense, everything, all eight of these steps are practice steps. Some of them are more almost philosophical, some of them are more in the real world, look at things, and some of them are very formal in terms of actual formal practice. But they're all interrelated and they all influence each other. I can't really practice wholesome speech if I'm not mindful, because I'll just fall into my old habit as a for instance. So this is, we don't want to ever think of this as having a beginning and an end. It goes deeper and deeper. Sometimes you see this image of, this practice as being like there's a mountain and we're going up slowly, going up the mountain. A teacher said a while ago, he said something, and I went, oh yeah. He said, actually, this is like a giant open pit mine. Ever seen a giant open pit mine? It's like this circular road that goes deeper and deeper and deeper and deeper into, and as we're going deeper and deeper into the practice until we get to the, not to the top, we get to the bottom. We get to the bottom of things and we go, oh, that's enlightenment. When we finally get to the bottom of things. It's a way to think about it. It's a different image. And so I like them just because it's like, I actually had a friend who used to drive trucks in open pit mines and used to tell me crazy stories about all the crazy things that happened in them. So it was just, it appealed to me because I had some understanding of it that in a different way. Anyhow, as usual, I'll finish with a little bit of poetry here. This is from Mary Oliver's book, Why I Wake Early, and it's called The Song of the Builders. On a summer morning, I sat down on the hillside to think about God, a worthy pastime. Near me, I saw a single cricket. It was moving the grains of the hillside this way and that way. How great was its energy! How humble its effort! Let us hope it will always be like this, each of us going on in our own inexplicable ways, building the universe. In our own inexplicable ways, building the universe. That's what we're doing with this practice. We're all building the universe in a way, the universe of goodness and wholesomeness and good things in the world. So. That's what I have to say tonight.